Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, snacky tunes. We'll be right back.
Welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. We are out in Santa Monica at the legendary Michael's Santa Monica. Welcome to the show, Michael McCartney, Chaz McCartney, and Miles Thompson. It's stunning out here.
Well, it's glad to have you guys here.
I mean, it's absolutely beautiful. I wish this is just like the, you see, you know, I remember the first time we came out here, we walked out, we're out in the patio, and I was like, damn. It's like, this is a restaurant. You've been here for a few years.
Yeah, just a few.
Just a few. It's crazy enough that you guys have been here for so long that you've had, like, different eras of a restaurant.
Yes.
I would probably say the amount of restaurants that have opened and closed since your opening,
yeah,
you could probably build a country out of and have nothing but restaurants. But now that you have Miles manning the ship in the back and Chaz, your son's up front, Michael, what's it like to look back on, like, years? I'm sorry, that's not fair. Decades.
Yeah, we're in our fourth decade.
Oh.
Actually, almost in our fifth.
I mean, that's crazy.
Yeah, but it's been a fantastic ride. You know, this is what the beauty of California is. You know, I grew up on the East Coast. Ironically, Miles and I have a very similar background. We both grew up in Westchester County.
Oh, nice.
We both had parents that loved to entertain and cook and eat. And they had friends that did the same thing. And my mother and father were just like that. They were wild. They had a great group. And there was always a party. So I always looked at it as when I went away to France the first time. I'm 16 years old, going to a program in Brittany.
What year is this?
This is in 1969.
Okay. So I'm not even...
Right.
I don't even think my parents had met yet.
Right. So this is what I'm saying. I go into New York City with my father and my mother and his best friend, and we eat in a restaurant called Laurent. Now, Laurent at the time, in any city, major city in the United States or the world, that matter, we're doing Escoffier-based cooking.
Sure.
So your job... sort of like the Olympics. Your job was, everybody does exactly the same. They just do it a little better.
Yeah.
But they cook exactly the same.
Yeah.
And Laurent was one of those Maxime-esque restaurants that right there you immediately see the wood moderne, the beveled glass, the tuxedoed waiters.
You've been there before, but you've never been there.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I see this. I'm sitting in there. We're having dinner. And I watch at the end of the meal, my parents and his friend, they argue over the bill. And at the same time, I'm watching this transaction, this interaction going in. In comes the owner, and the electricity level in this room went through the roof.
Yeah.
So it was a combination of watching my parents' parties.
Yeah.
Turned into a business.
Sure.
But also a show and a fantastic experience.
Yeah. I mean, it's food during that time, restaurants.
Yeah.
It is not glamorized like the way it is today.
Exactly.
Like today, if I went home and I was like, all right, I'm becoming a chef, my parents would be like, oh, that's great. You're going to be on TV. You'll be all over Instagram, things like that.
Right.
But back then, it was it was blue-collar work. It was not glorified. It was like...
No, it wasn't a career for American. Young men and women in America that were Americans did not go as a career choice into the restaurant business as chefs at all.
No, it was very much like an immigrant story.
Exactly. They were all from... And fortunately, in an odd way, most of the people that owned the top restaurants in Boston, Chicago, LA, New York, all of which were basically the same restaurant, based on Le Pavillon, you know, basically, since 1939, were hotel and restaurant school trained in Switzerland or in England or in France or in Germany. Very few Americans were in the business.
Yeah.
But that next morning, I got on a boat to go to France.
And from New York.
From New York, and it was a student boat, and I can tell you it was a student boat because it took 11 days to get there.
Sure.
That's good news.
Because you made it?
Because we made it. No, because it was 11 days of the wildest time you would ever imagine,
It
was an Italian-run boat. Mm. And the beauty of this boat was all of these hot-looking Italian waiters, five meals a day, even though it was students. Mm. And it was this whole Dolce Vita, the whole Italian thing that you didn't see in America.
Right.
You didn't see that because Italian restaurants sucked in America in the 70s.
Right, because you were getting the French experience when it was fine dining.
Exactly. Yeah. And so this was this other fantastic thing. And then I land in France and I go to Brittany. Brittany is a fantastic coastal peninsula that's absolutely over the top food-wise, shellfish, everything. You can't believe it.
Yeah.
But I also lived in a family there that was totally in to the party scene. They were a folklore company.
I'm seeing a
theme here
of party and good time and
party, good time.
You know, here's the thing: your parents, family, they're either into hosting, and I'm sure you can say this about your dad. They're either into hosting or they're not.
Right.
Like some people are not gregarious like that. Some people are like, this is my house.
Right.
I don't want people in it.
Yeah.
Or some people go, door's always open. There's always a meal.
Yeah, I grew up in more the merrier.
His family, if I could only like fully point out how insane they are.
Yeah.
Like the way that we just went up to see them last week. His mom's 95.
Yeah.
And she still just parties. So it drinks me under the table. Every good. Single time.
But that's the way I feel like it should be. You should never be able to outdrink the generation above you.
Right.
I think that's the way it goes. So you're in France.
Right.
I mean, the where you went to the top schools there.
Yeah.
But what brings you back to what brings you back to California?
Well, that was it. After I did that class, that 1 year in Berkeley, that's where I learned about the hotel and restaurant schools, cookie school. We didn't have cookie schools in America like you have today. The CIA was a afterthought for the vets.
Yeah.
You know, I have the cookbook from the original CIA. Take the number 10 can, open it up, bring it to a simmer, serve.
God. Yeah.
So,
and I bet you people still got it wrong.
They probably got it wrong. But from there, I came back. As my mother said, you got to get a high school diploma. And then I went back to Paris, where I learned about the schools, and I went to the hotel and restaurant school, which is where you would go if you were a French kid. I was a little older. I was 17. They were all like 15, but it was a riot. And then I also went to the Cordon Bleu at the same time.
Yeah.
And this is the first half of the 70s. And then I went to the Académie du Vin, which Steven Spurrier, I don't know if you saw the movie Bottle Shock.
Yep.
Alan played my teacher, Steven. So I did all, and in those days, by the way, in the wine business, talk about simple.
Yeah.
You had Bordeaux, Burgundy, Loire, and Champagne.
Yeah.
Maybe they discussed the Côte du Rhône, and that was it. There was no Italian wine discussed.
No.
Because they didn't make good Italian wine in those days. Remember, this is the 70s.
Man, Italy really just fell off, for a couple decades.
Not until 85 did they come back.
Yeah.
That's a whole other story.
That's a whole other story.
Yeah. But at any rate, so then when I was finished and graduated,
and what year
I had
is
a
this?
Little bistro in 1974.
Yeah.
I had a little bistro on that I was running. On Ile Saint-Louis, and that's where I began to develop my style of modern American food, based with the important thing of learning the Escoffier-style cooking, but being in Paris during those 4 or 5 years when the Nouvelle Cuisine Revolution was exploding.
Yeah.
When Michel Gérard was just beginning his... our graduation present to ourselves was we ate with the two Trois Gros brothers. Then we went over to see Paul Bocuse. Then we went to La Pyramide. While we were at La Pyramide, the mother, because he had died earlier, the mother said, you have time to go to one more restaurant because this guy's the best. And I said, where is it? Well, it's in Switzerland. And I said, well, you know, yeah, but it's right over there. You could just get there shortly. So we went to Freddy Girardet.
Fine.
And that was sort of like, hello, we got it. Then I called up my mother and I said, all right, what are we doing here? And my father, they had moved to Malibu, California.
Okay.
So in 75, I moved out here to Malibu, California.
Yeah.
And I walked into this in December.
Into Michael's.
Into this weather.
Oh,
into
this,
into Malibu, and said, this is where I'm going to do it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, let's talk about the culinary scene in Santa Monica, Malibu in 75. What was it like back then?
Well, there wasn't one.
Okay.
You know, you had, again, the same scenario that we talked about.
Was there high-end, because, you know, when you talk about the high-end cuisine of New York, you know, you always hear French in New York.
And yeah, like same thing here.
And it,
you had five restaurants, and the best one and the most intelligent chef about the whole thing was Jean Bertrand at L'Hermitage.
Yeah.
And he was already beginning to understand and embrace Nouvelle Cuisine, but change it into the next level, more realistic. You had L'Orangerie, you had Saint-Germain, you had L'Hermitage, you had the Old Guard, Chasen's, Scandia, Perino's, the famous continental Italian restaurant. You know, that's what that was. And that was it. There was Au Petit Café was the beginning of, it's sort of like it was a Michael's.
Mm-hmm.
And he began to train a generation of waiters that went out and opened restaurants. So for example, Le Restaurant Saint-Germain, L'Hermitage, Le Dôme.
Yeah.
They all work there. So it's
all French.
All French. Yeah.
I mean, so when you start the restaurant and you have this vision, did you have a clear vision of what the food was going to be? Obviously, it's changed over four decades, but what was it like to try and open a high-end restaurant that wasn't classic French?
Well, it was easy because, you see, what I'd been developing over these years was a style of cooking. Remember, all those restaurants we talked about, they did 50, 60 people a night.
Yeah.
And when it took me 2 years to find this location, to find the space, and this street was Tumbleweed City. The mall was closed. the Third Street Promenade.
Yeah.
Tumbleweed time, you know. But I had to have a garden. I had to have an outdoor space.
Sure.
Because all those restaurants we talked about, they were all indoor restaurants.
Right.
You know, except for Ma Maison, which had its shed out there, kind of a deal, its tent.
Sure.
It was all an indoor experience. And so to do this correctly, I already decided to live in Malibu. I wasn't going to drive into Beverly Hills, which was where the food scene was. And when I walked around this was a pub called the Brigadoon.
Mm.
And so there was a sense of feeling in there that was fantastic. You know, as nutty as those pubs are, it really was. It glowed, basically. I walked around the corner. I saw this backyard, which was derelict. And I said, this is it.
Yeah.
Cool little California bungalow, backyard. This is going to be the new Michaels.
So let's talk about those early years.
Yeah.
So you get it open. What year does it open?
1979.
And what were those first 5 years like? Because, you know, what was it like to be doing this type of food out here? How did people respond?
Right.
How did you keep the doors open?
Well, that was, again, there's all kinds of planets in a row kind of a thing.
Yeah.
You had a very interesting time where I had spent 2 years before with Jean-Bert Renou as my partner in a duck farm. Because we started to sort out ingredients,
mm-hmm,
and what was good and what was bad and what was local and what we could find. And it was pretty bleak.
Yeah.
You know, in 1979, most of the fish you bought from your food purveyors was frozen.
Mm.
None of the meat was aged.
Yeah.
Aged. Today, you know, people age of like 9 million years.
Yeah.
And there, none.
This is from prehistoric era.
Yeah. The only thing really fantastic as a product was their steak.
Yeah.
And once I convinced, you know, a superior, Frank, to age it, it became a fantastic product.
Sure.
And I said, 28 days, that's what I've done myself. This is the way to do it. 4 weeks, not less, not more.
So you guys are helping shape the distribution network and helping people. But you're also giving, you know, because when you ask people, farmers and producers, to change the way they do it, you need to be like, I will buy. It's like futures.
Well,
like, I'm
going
to buy this. I will buy this for you.
Not only that, we provided the seeds.
Sure.
You know, up in Oxnard, in Imperial Valley, in northern Mexico, you know, where the wine country is right now, that whole area and the Imperial Valley, which is east of San Diego, San Joaquin, obviously, San Fernando. Our first salad was San Fernando Valley Greens, you know, because we got a guy to plant that. We brought in all the seeds from France. And again, I brought everything in from France. My biggest mistake in life was not finding, you know, FedEx. That's what I should have been doing.
Were you just smuggling them in?
Yeah. I mean, from during the duck days, you know, before I opened the restaurant, my mentor on the ducks was from Australia.
Mm.
And he said, you ever had any John Dory? And I said, you mean like Saint Pierre? And he says, yes. Well, we have it here.
Wow.
So I'd get Saint Pierre and Rouget from New Zealand and from Australia. Those boysenberries, that's why I was so thrilled to see them. Olala berries, blackberries, raspberries, because again, I'm sort of a kid. I figured, what? You mean you got these in season? I forget that when it's winter here, it's summer there.
Sure.
So it was like unbelievable.
That's
amazing. And the same thing for France. We brought all the cheeses in. We brought all the fish in. This was way before local. People talk about farm to table. We had to build the farms to get to farm to table.
So when now you're open for a few years, and what was, you know, I mean, what were those middle, before you start thinking about, like, the legacy and the next act and things like that. Like, what were those middle years like?
Well, what we set up in the beginning, like I said, there weren't any cooking schools.
So yeah.
If you, we had to train everybody. So the school, it started as almost a school. And as I've explained, you know, you're learning from the guy on the right and you're teaching the guy on the left.
Yeah.
Or the girl.
Sure.
And so many things were accomplished here in the very beginning. The style of cooking, the ingredients, raw diver scallops from Maine with a puree of heirloom beets and French olive oil in 1979. You know, you had to go. What I realized on everything that we did was creating a menu and designing the dishes, curating the dishes, then training my first opening staff, which was Ken Frank, Jonathan Waxman, Mark Peel, Billy Flug.
I don't know
Jimmy Brinkley.
I've never heard of them,
right?
No one.
Billy was the best one, and he's not with us anymore.
I know.
He was a fantastic chef. And this was the best lunch place in town because as it sorted out over the first nine months, he was the lunch guy.
Yeah.
Jonathan became the chef. Ken left to open up north.
Yeah.
And Mark became his, you know, chef de cuisine. And Jimmy Brinkley, who was a fantastic American, who, like, I spent 6 months with him redesigning all of my French menus of all the pastries and desserts to Americanize them. In other words, less booze, less sugar, making them more tasty. It's, again, we did everything like that, whether it was the chickens. you know, the duck that we grew. We had our own duck farm. You know, everything was to say, how do you take what we've got here and modernize it? And so I curated this entire menu. We began the collaboration with these chefs. But within months, I realized that this was where I had to be.
Yeah.
Because going out to the dining room and explaining what arugula was to people, not only just one kind,
but it was an education.
It was. What do you mean you eat raw scallops? You don't cook the scallops?
Right.
You don't try it. You're going to love this. And again, the wine thing. Fortunately, I had a fantastic wine guy, Phil Reich. But again, so that was this whole process. And that went on for years, almost 10 years.
Wow.
And then bit by bit, we had another generation. Nancy Silverton came to work here.
Sure.
She was my night cashier. She was then the night producer of the sorbets and production. And then she was assistant pastry. Then she was the pastry chef. Then I sent her to France to work with Poilin and with the Le Note at the school there. With Jimmy, too, at the same time. And then, of course, Mark and Nancy went on to open the first Spago in the mid-'80s there. But, again, it continues to be that. And it just worked itself, always evolving.
Yeah, always evolving. Well, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to talk about the evolution. We're going to talk about Chaz, you coming to work in and just keeping this. And then, Miles, we're going to talk about what it means to pick up the mantle of a restaurant that's been around for four decades and how to keep it true to itself and then bring into the new generation.
Yeah, well, this is what's fantastic about this. This is an absolute continuation of the thread. And, you know, it's just, it couldn't be better. We have had such a blast. We've had the good, the bad, and the ugly, but it's such a blast, and we're just poised to really run this game for a while. The food is fantastic, what Miles is doing.
It's amazing. Well, we're going to talk a little bit more after the break. We have a song from the archives on Snacky Tunes here on heritageradionetwork.org. Org.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We are out here in Santa Monica at Michael's, four decades in of a restaurant. Michael, 20 years in, 30 years in, when do you start thinking about, okay, we're going to be here for a while, when do you start thinking about how we're going to keep growing, when do you start thinking about bringing Chaz in?
Well, first of all, a lot of things happen, like happenstance.
Yeah.
You know, if just to go back 1 second.
Yeah.
The big middle years were in 92 when we had the complete meltdown of L.A. We had the riots after the verdict of Rodney King. We had the huge fires that burned the whole joint down. Then we had the earthquake right after that. We had the end of the construction industry. We had the end of the aerospace industry. Ending up, the good news is in 30 months we took care of business with O.J.'s trial.
Yeah.
You know, so within those months, everything disaster occurred.
Yeah.
But that's what gave me the moment to say, what are we going to do next? Because we had to shut everything down to a very small schedule. We were only open 5 nights a week, no brunch, no Sunday nights. I went out there, and walking in my door was David Rossoff and Sang Yoon.
Mm.
And they were my opening team, January 1995. And I sat down
with
those.
It's like the start. It's like you're a sports team. You're like, all right, this year on the roster, this is who we've drafted. Got a new young guy coming in.
Yeah, there were a lot in between there, between the opening crew and that. But we sat down because you ask what happened or what. Sometimes nature tees it up. And that's what happened, because we sat here, this building we almost destroyed. If we hadn't rebuilt it the way we rebuilt it when we first did it, it would have been gone.
You know, right.
We put in huge, to open up that space. We had to put in giant columns and girders and things like that. And so we sat down and we said, okay, what are we going to do next? And we created another version. Now, this is how many years after the 95? So that's almost 16 years after we've been open. And we reinvented this restaurant. And just so you understand, then we can flip forward.
Yeah.
That game ran all the way until the fourth quarter of 2008.
Hmm.
And it just got better and better, and we had more chefs coming in, people, you know, doing their whole thing, and it was fantastic, all within the same theme. So you remember, that's sort of why we've been here, because I had this vision, and we kept this vision of the overall experience of all the components of the front of the house, the back of the house, and the space, all the way up until 2008, and that's when it was nuts.
Yeah, when the financial...
When the Lehman Brothers and Bernie Madoff sealed the deal for the end of the world.
I think he really did.
Out here. He did.
No, yeah. There. Now, Chaz, did you grow up in the restaurant? Like, how often were you here as a kid?
So I was like the 4-year-old at the table with a bunch of 55-year-olds.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have an iPad. I didn't have crayons. I kind of just sat there quietly and stared up in the space as a bunch of crazy friends of my parents, you know, members of Devo and artists were just had no interest in talking. Like, you know, they dug my psychedelic 5-year-old brain, but
they
couldn't. So I kind of watched a lot, and I would fall asleep in the bar.
Amazing.
And on the couches we had at the time, and I would come here after school, and I would get picked up by Mike 3 hours late after he had a big lunch somewhere. And I observed, you know, I was kind of a little daydreamer. And then, you know, I would have 3 days off from school in seventh grade, and Mike would throw me on the line or something, or have me prep beats, and I'd cut up my fingers. And
fair enough.
Say, fuck this, I'm never doing it again. And
but when did it change?
So I worked here off and on very briefly, but I spent a lot of time here observing.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no real restaurant experience. I came back after college. We'd gotten killed by the recession, and it seemed kind of like some challenge. When I graduated, you know, Santa Monica kind of, this is 2011, Santa Monica had for rent signs everywhere. There was tumbleweeds. It was kind of a return back to 1979.
Yeah.
Nobody really gave a shit about it. Food was changing in this way where, like, you would go to Animal. You know, I was 21. I'd go to Animal. I'd see this kind of aggressive, no art on the walls, like, this style of change, like, service that was, you know, didn't really seem to care about you. It was just about, like, moving through. And Michael's at the time had, like, green velvet chairs, white tablecloths, absolutely nobody in it. Style of food had changed, as he will say.
Yeah.
And Santa Monica was changing. Restaurants were closing left and right. So I kind of stood around and looked around, and, you know, I was my head wasn't in the restaurant. 5 years later, I live in a bunch of different places, work a bunch of jobs, kind of keep crossing things off the list. I have like this neuroses. I can't sit down.
Yeah.
I can't sit down and do an office job. And I can't not interact with people. That was a big part of it. So
it's in your blood. It's in your blood to host.
So around like 2015, you know, after 4 years of me dropping by the restaurant, I'm living in the opposite side of town. I'm living in Echo Park. I'm like seeing those restaurants. Nothing is blowing my brains yet. I hadn't been to Alamet. I you know, I come in every once in a while. I'm like, Michael, what's the music you're playing?
Right.
Michael, what are you doing with this menu? Like, Michael, why are you playing this music?
What music was he playing?
I came in and I sat at that table in that corner, table 36, and they were playing dubstep. And it was just like, I was like,
Michael.
No. Michael, we need to change the music. Mike's like, hey, nobody cares about the music. They like the food. And I'm like, we need to change the music. You know, like, what's going on? I remember being a kid and there would be Chet Baker and Miles Davis playing. And
classic.
Like, people, you know, the waiters were dancing through the hallway, essentially. Yeah. There was so much movement, choreography. And, you know, I got to this point, like, I finished up one of my jobs and I was like, all right, I'm coming back. Like, you're not going to listen to me? Like, let's do this. If we're going to do it, if we're going to revitalize this, let's do it right. Let's kick the doors down. I'm like a face your trauma, go into the desert, take a bag of mushrooms, work through it, you know?
Yeah, I mean,
work it out.
Work it out.
And,
yeah,
and
you put on some Chet Baker and take some mushrooms.
Housework.
And so we, you know, we kind of came back, and I saw that there was need for movement and staff, so we started scouting, manager, private party planner, started, you know, removing some elements of it that just needed to be removed, bringing some new ones in, bringing a new style to it. But what we were looking for was a chef.
Yeah.
And a chef who could really kind of return it back to this rather interesting and interestingly curated style and point of view that very much went along with our personality.
And always part of the progressive aspect of the restaurant.
Well, I think a big part of that was, like, we didn't want to be, like, a glorified bistro. We didn't want to be a happy hour place. That wasn't our personality.
Yeah.
That's what the neighborhood kind of was turning towards, but we knew that we needed our neighborhood, but we needed to become and return back to what we were.
Yeah. Now, Miles, during this time, you were at some of those restaurants, Animal, Son of a Gun, so you were part of that, I would say, LA Revolution. I would say that was definitely, and I know that from being on the East Coast, those were the restaurants and those were the names that were popping up that started having everyone go like, okay, LA, like, you're making a move. What was it like to be part of that scene?
Man, it was totally magical. I mean, the way that I started working at Animal was my chef and mentor, Alex Becker, when I worked at Nobu, basically came up to me one day and pretty much told me to go work for John and Vinny.
Get out of here.
He was like, you know, they're opening another restaurant, right? I saw him at the farmer's market. You're going to drop your resume off?
Yeah.
I mean, he knew. I'd been to the restaurant. We went. I was, like, invited into, like, the sous chef circle with Alex and his chef Jason and Kim and the GM. Like, we all went to Animal one night at, like, 1 in the morning because they were open super late.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I remember seeing, like, Vinny up in the office walking around and there was this kind of, like, holy light around him. I was like, this is the kind of food that I want to learn and cook and all this. And he's like, you got to do it. So obviously I was like, yes, chef. And I went home that night, you know, after probably like, who knows, some long night of service. It wasn't the weekend. And I went to go to Animal and the next day. And I went up there around 2 o'clock in the afternoon and I saw the hosts in there and there was like the chain link, like, gate that comes down and, like, trying to, like, reach through and, like, knock on the window. I was like, can I get
a job? Yeah.
And so I gave them my resume and I just hoped for the best and got a call. And, you know, long story short, I ended up working for those guys. And it was awesome. Like, I remember working at Animal the night that they broke 200. Like, the night that, like, that was the first night that they did over 200 covers in the restaurant. 54C restaurant.
That's
four
bonkers.
Turns. I mean, we were just getting crushed. I remember, like, I worked a station called The Pit because it's in the corner. It would get like 115 degrees. It's a double French top. And you'd pick up like all the meat and the fish dishes and then like the poutine and, you know, kind of set up some of the sauces for like the foie dishes and stuff like that. And I just remember getting killed in there and just loving it. Like, just give me more, give me
like,
more.
Like, yeah, bury me, bury
just
me.
Hit me.
More,
you know,
tickets.
Like, 9 poutine deep, 3 fish, 6 steaks. Like, what's going to happen next? And I just love the food, and I love the camaraderie, and I love that everyone who was there is like, you know, 45-year-old grizzled line cook who'd been through everything and been an executive chef on like a private island off of Nantucket, and like just wanted to work for these guys. And then a kid from Kansas who like made the dirtiest flapjacks you ever had in your life and but was like the best line cook with the most style you've ever seen. And just all these guys, it was just this, I love the fact that it didn't matter who you were, it didn't matter if you had ever been to culinary school, yeah. It just mattered that you, for lack of a better term, gave a fuck. And like just wanted to be part of something that was really progressive and cool. And if you had an interest and a point of view and you wanted to taste delicious food, you could work there. And that was what it was all about.
That's amazing. Now, yeah. When did you first hear of Michael's? Or did you always know about it as being a chef in the LA scene?
I always knew about Michael's. I mean, I had a proclivity for reading menus all the time and for just like searching online for like what's the best restaurant in Santa Monica, what's the best restaurant in Culver City, what's the best this, what's the best that, and I'd always see Michael's would always come up, you know, early in my career when I was in Los Angeles, and I was always curious and I was always thinking I should get there, I gotta see what this is all about, but I'd never eaten in the restaurant, and I knew the story and the history and it was fascinating, so I've always known about it.
Yeah. And how did, so you were cooking at these restaurants and you were over in Echo Park at Alumet. And where did you guys all meet? Was it in Echo Park, or I know that you had left LA for a little bit. How did you guys all start talking?
Well, I was down in the Caribbean. I was working on a small island called St. Kitts, which is like a very, very, the smallest independent nation in the world. St. Kitts and Nevis. You know, the small, it's, you know, basically a 40 square mile island with, you know, 46,000 people living on it. My wife and I were basically developing a food and hospitality program for a high-level resort there. And the job was just kind of ending.
Yeah.
The kind of things changed. And I sent out some texts to Kevin Meehan and Zach Pollock, and I was like, do you guys know anyone that is looking for a chef or a CDC or Executive Sue or someone who's doing something cool?
Yeah.
You know, I'm looking to come back to Los Angeles, and you know, I love California. I've always loved Los Angeles, and then Zach actually emailed both of us and got us in touch. And Kevin said, you know, Michael's is looking for a chef as well. And so then we just started talking, and I sent a resume, you know, CV and everything over, and said, when are you going to be in town? And I was going to be in LA for a vacation. So we sat down right at that table over there, and we went to the farmer's market.
Yeah,
it was a Wednesday morning.
When I finally called him on the phone, I said, so where are you now? He said, I'm in LA. I said, great. What are you doing Wednesday morning? It's Tuesday night. I said, what are you doing tomorrow? And I said, let's go to the market.
Yeah.
So Chaz and I met him here at 7:30. And already I knew this was the right move. Why? Because within 5 seconds, Chaz and Miles were walking down talking like this. And Gramps was in the back here just sort of like going, this is working.
This is working.
This is good. And then we hit the market. And this is sort of what we were talking about earlier with Instagram. Yeah. I hit the market and I watched the reaction of all of the farmers that I knew when they saw Miles coming out and embracing him.
Yeah.
When the chefs that never speak to me, right, all correct. The hot young chefs with their tats and their this and their that, all look at Miles and go, oh my God, I don't believe it. And I knew the vibe was there. And in fact, to sort of do an interesting thing, I hired Miles without ever tasting his food.
That's bold.
But that's I bold. Saw...
You saw he could shop, though.
I saw he could shop.
And also the diligence and care that went into the way that he talked about products. I mean, a big part of what I... Also, there's a weird side story of 2000... When did Alamet close? 13?
Close in... What year is it now?
2017.
Close in 2014.
Okay, so I was living in Echo Park 2014. Randomly, one day, check LA Weekly, see that this beloved Miles Thompson, whose restaurant I never went to because I didn't have any money, like, was closing. And I, for some random reason, checked LA Weekly that time. I sent it to Michael, totally out of the blue, had nothing to do with the restaurant, said, this is the guy we should get. 3 years later, he's the first name we get on the chef.
Yeah,
that's amazing. Search. It's fun. It's funny how it works like that.
Yeah.
So let's... So you've kicked down the doors, right? You changed the music. No more dubstep. Thank you.
I miss my dubstep.
You know, there's no more velvet chairs. There's no more white tablecloth.
Right.
Miles is now in the kitchen.
Right.
what is it like to be in this? I mean, I don't even know. I can't even put. I know you earlier said third act. That's not fair. This is like this is like Macbeth. It's like act five, act six, act seven. Like, how does it all come together, and what's the response been?
Well, you have to also understand that when we sat with Miles, we said, again, just like when I sat with Sang-Yoon and David Rossoff, I said, what are we going to do here? This always has been a collaboration thing. Chaz, Miles, what are we going to do here? I will give you the best sandbox you've ever seen here. Mm-hmm. And we gutted this place. We shut it for a month. Gutted it. We put in the tables and the chairs and the garden. We modernized it. You can see we rehung the entire art collection, put in a new playlist.
Yes.
And Miles trained the staff while we were closed every day.
That's
on the
amazing.
New menu.
That's huge.
Front and back of the house.
To learn off the clock.
Yeah.
I can only imagine how amazing that's been.
Yeah.
Just and to teach them. It's a re-education.
It was.
Yeah.
But we made the decision we're going to do this.
And the rare thing about Miles, too, is that he has an amazing ability to not only be, you know, a culinary creative genius and like a very progressive force in combining very wild yet not weird for the sake of being weird compositions on a plate. He understands people in a pretty amazing way where he can do, you know, one lap in the garden and be like, why is this not like this? Why is this not like this? Like, he sees it. He understands people and is calm and patient with them in a way that a lot of cooks aren't.
Miles, how does it feel to have... to be the helm of a restaurant that's older than a good chunk of us at the table?
I mean, it's one of those things where you appreciate it deeply, but you really try not to think about it too much. I just come in every day, and I want to do the best that I can to honor the history. I mean, if I were to sit down and just, like, look through the photo albums, I would freak myself out.
Yeah.
You know, look at who's been through here. Look at where they are now. It's incredibly... It fills me with a lot of, you know... joy and pride and hope for my future, but it also fills me with a lot of, you know, excitement for what's happening right now.
Yeah.
Because this is huge. This is a huge thing, and I've always heard about Michael's, and I knew about, you know, the history here, and to be a part of it is just, it blows my mind in a way that, like, if I think about it, I'm just gonna freak out.
Yeah, it's like being on the Lakers.
Yeah.
It's like I can't think about Kobe. I can't think about Magic.
Right.
You just got to play every night,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So, Michael, final question. Almost five decades in, what's it been like? How do you see another five decades in front of you?
Well, we have to get Silicon Valley working on the biomedical stuff for that.
Yes.
Really
yes.
Logistic. But
yes.
I'm there, and I'm sure they're working on it.
Yeah.
You know what? This restaurant has always evolved. It's taken its punches, it's recuperated it, it's come back, it's thoughtfully decided what environment are we in, where are we going to go with it, what could we do? We're not just tracing trends. And that was how we made it through all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the vast majority of the people that eat in this restaurant in the last 9 months didn't even know this restaurant existed because of the explosion of restaurants in this town.
Mm-hmm.
Echo Park, Silver Lake, downtown, Culver City, Venice, Santa Monica. So, yeah, maybe it was in the sort of the sphere out there, the ether. But the truth is, it's, you know, we received virtually no press for like 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so all of a sudden, now, people are coming in. And again, as I said earlier, the generation. You know, Miles was 25 when he started. Now here we are 4 years later. The generation eating in all those restaurants are now 4 or 5 years later, or 10 years later. That was no different than 79 when young Hollywood wanted a place of their own. You know, when you talk about Katzenberg and Eisner and Diller and Spielberg and Hanks, they were 30 years old.
Yeah.
This was their place. And it's continually happened through that. We've been able to manage, as I say before, a restaurant is like a sailboat. You got to learn to sail it in a gale force and in a dead calm, but you can always move it forward. And that's what we've done here. And this is so exciting. And Roni, our new Assam, she's pulled a list together that is commensurate with what we call modern American food. Now, if you go back to the press in 1979, that's what we called it, modern American food. So it's sort of like, here we are, 38, almost 40 years later, and we're doing the new version of modern American food.
It's amazing. Well, all of you, congratulations.
Thank you.
It's amazing. It's very rare to be able to sit in a restaurant that's been open and continues to grow and look forward. I wish you all the best.
to another 40 years. And we have another song. Where can people, actually, before I even toss to that, where can people find you online? Are you guys on Instagram?
Oh, yeah. We have a huge Instagram account, a huge, huge. Twitter feed, huge. What's the other thing? Facebook.
Yeah.
But more importantly, go to the website.
Michael's?
MichaelsSantaMonica.com. There's a fantastic photograph that we'll show you when you're
through. Oh, I've seen it. It's
okay,
amazing.
Okay, but have you seen how it works?
Yes, I've seen how it flips.
it flips to the new.
The new generation.
Yeah.
It's always great. Well, listen, I can't thank you enough for opening up a place and having a place that has led to really so many amazing restaurants and really just helped influence the LA dining scene and beyond. We have a song from the archives on Snacky Tunes and then a live performance coming up in the other half of the show on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cookie machine. What better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We have Wayne Glass, a.k.a. Dream Crusher, here in studio. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hey. How are you?
I'm good.
This is so awkward.
Just look at me.
Okay.
We'll make it easy.
Boom.
Boom. Yeah, it's a two-person connection.
Eyes, boom.
You grew up in Wichita, Kansas.
Yes, unfortunately.
What was it like making music there, given you've spoken extensively about it was somewhat isolating? How did you begin to find your voice and figure out the music you were going to make, considering how solo of an endeavor it seemed?
I don't know. I should spit my gum out on the radio. That might help situation. I was raised by a hippie mom, and she was just like, do what you want. Like you shouldn't worry about what other people are doing, because like, it's one of those cities where like, it's small enough to where everyone knows everyone, but unless you impress them, they don't act like they don't know you, you know what I mean? So it's really easy to, I don't know, in a way it's really good to feel that isolated, because then you can really, that's sweet, thank you. it gives you more of an opportunity to develop yourself in an insular way, but it also fucks up your head. Like, you could turn into Yandick and just chop your ear off or something. I don't know.
How did you discover noise music? Of all the music out there, how did that one find you, and how did what about it made you respond in the way that you did?
Well, again, my hippie mom was like, you're not gonna only listen to Criss Cross and fucking Another Bad Creation. There's like a lot of different kinds of music that black people came up with also. And like, she came up with like all these crates of her like vinyl records that she'd been collecting since she was a kid. And it was like Sun Ra and Miles Davis and shit like that. And Delia Derbyshire, I think is her name is. The person that came up with sampling or invented sampling. And people like that. And I don't know. She planted a seed, grew a tree with lots of leaves in me. So like, it sparked my curiosity. I'm innately curious, which is why I have so many bruises. But yeah, that's kind of how it came up. I have to point this out. I don't ever hear white noise artists being asked how they got into noise. I think that's interesting. Not calling you out.
I would ask. It's more the genre itself. I think it's more because I don't listen to many noise artists, and okay. It's so specific. One of my best friends is also into noise, and anytime you ask a noise artist about it, they're like, they just start listing all the references, and like they're almost all noise artists are walking encyclopedias of the entire noise thing. It's such a specific type of music that I think that I would ask anybody who, I would say this, for someone who grew up isolated in Wichita, Kansas, you picked a musical genre that was even more isolating than if you were like, oh, I'm going to make hip hop records or I'm going to make R&B records. Like, no, how do I push people even further away just from the pure sonic landscape? Yeah. So it's more that interest, less like you're a black person making noise music out of Kansas.
True. Yeah. And I will add, like, I didn't really know that many people that were into noise either.
I mean, so. No one does. Unless you lived in Boston at a certain time.
Like, right, yeah. In Boston in a fucking, like, flea infested.
Right. And like, with like eight other people. And like, it wasn't even lofted. It was just kind of like mattresses.
Oh, yeah. Mattresses with like sunspots on them and shit.
How long did it take for you to develop your sound? I mean, you're insanely prolific. Like, how? What was the record, number 5 out of 30? Or did you feel like you kind of tapped into it pretty early on?
I will admit I was really trying to copy Autechre when I was first starting out, because that was when Untilted came out. Mm-hmm. It's are you familiar mm-hmm. with that? So I was obsessed with that record. I was obsessed with Confield too. Confield is my favorite record of theirs. But like, I was like super. I was into it enough to like try to emulate it. But I was also into Justice and Daft Punk and stuff like that. I was like trying to be normal.
Yeah,
this is all like early college. I think that was when I decided that dance music was boring, and I just started like, I'll go further back. Like, the first noise band, quote unquote, I heard was Einstürzende Neubauten, and I found it on MTV. Like, they, when MTV played music at one point,
and they played noise music too. Yeah.
Yeah. They used to have like the, what is it called, AMP, mm-hmm. and sometimes, very seldomly, they would play like fucked up shit. So, like, they would play, what's the guy's name? Not Soft Pink. Grayish Pink, I can't remember his name. He's, like, an Australian performance artist. They would play mostly performance art in addition to fucked up music. And that was, like, my introduction to it. And then BBC America would also play, like, Live from Jules Holland. And then it'd be, like Massive Attack and shit like that. But that like, really informed me. And then when I got into college, I started to rediscover that stuff because I wasn't in my mom's house with no internet. So it was like, I got reintroduced to that stuff, and it was like, it was easier for me to experiment with whatever programs I was using, because I was remembering, there are more possibilities than ... Mm. There's also all these things in the spectrum of otherness that can inform you too.
And you studied fine arts.
Yes.
Did that play into you crafting your identity and your music, or how did the thinking of fine arts education play into the music that you made?
I just remember hating the curriculum so much that it made me want to like go into my room and never come out and just like make the loudest fucking shit ever. But I had a professor, the first advanced class I took where you came up with your own shit. Wait, can we cuss? Okay. All right. How you doing? One of my professors was like, oh, have you heard of DNA? I'm like, of course I've heard of DNA. He's like, have you heard of James Chance? I was like, of course I've heard of James Chance. And so we like became friends because of that. And he didn't know I made music. And there was a place across the street from my university called Kirby's.
What and city it, is this?
Wichita.
Okay.
And it's fucking hilarious. It's a dive bar. Like, but that's where I saw fucking Cologne D'Or, I think their name is. It's like a Russian noise artist that was like sewing a fucking contact mic into his chest. Like they booked the craziest shit in this like terrible dive bar that's right by a laundromat in the middle of nowhere, like that type of shit. And I was performing there one night, as I usually was, because that was the only place that ever booked weird shit. And my professor was there, and he was like, what? You didn't tell me you did this? And I was like, I didn't. You grade my papers. I'm not going to tell you that. But yeah, that was like at the point where the two started to intersect. Because then I think just in full, like I went back home recently, and I have like boxes and boxes of sketchbooks. And I looked in them, and I was like, oh, I've been drawing like record covers and track lists for fake albums that have never been made since I was like 4. So, like,
do you think that you had to put out so many records because you already had the artwork done? You're like, if I had the artwork done, I might as well make a record.
Kinda, yeah, pretty much.
You're like, that album cover is really good. I'll write like 10 tracks and just get it out there.
Yeah. I, no lie, like when I was active on MySpace, I was uploading like an album's worth of material like every other week, like. It was like a little much, and like, I don't know how I passed high school.
I think that it's two different types of muscle memory.
Yeah.
You're just kind of like doing one thing. I don't think it's the same thing now. It's like you're pulling just from different things.
Yeah, totally.
Can we hear a song?
Oh, sure.
What are you going to play for us first?
I want to give people that aren't, can't see me a picture of what I'm looking at. I'm looking at the a crowd full of people that are like A, can afford this pizza. B, probably live in like a really like can afford to live in this neighborhood. And C, like would not make eye contact with me if I walked out completely naked. You know what I mean? So this first song is called Shopping. It's like a new record, and it's about how consumerism turns you into a Nazi.
Here we go, live on Snacky Tunes.
Ha 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 ha. Ha ha ha. Oh shit. Okay, how am I doing this? Did I scare the kids away?
A little bit. There's like one child that ran off.
Good.
What brought you to New York?
I'm really close to the mic now. What the fuck is wrong with me? I went on tour with a musician named MP Lockwood that does a project called Radio Shock. Why am I sweating? Oh, because I was screaming into a mic for a solid 5 minutes. I went on tour with him. It was like only a week, and it was like an East Coast tour.
Was that your first time out on the East Coast?
Yes. And
what did it look like to you?
It looked like the Midwest.
Yeah.
Until I got to New York, I think. Well, that was the first time I was on a plane too. It was weird. What was I gonna say? Yeah, I did a GoFundMe to do a tour. And I only got halfway, And he had sent me a message saying, like, hey, if you, I know what it's like to, like, be from a small town and, like, not be able to, like,
get out.
Yeah. And he was like, just come on tour with me. And, like, when the tour was over, he was like, you can use the money we got to go back home, or you can, like, stay here. And I looked and I was like, I'm staying. But yeah,
And what was it? I mean, I know the story's been told through, like, a million different people, but, like, what did New York look to you, and what did it feel like to you when you got here?
Okay, so I was fucking scared as shit to be here because, my mom makes me scared of everything, but also, in my head, I thought it was, like, the Warriors. Mm. And, like, it's not like that.
Not anymore.
It's definitely not anymore. When I got off the plane at LaGuardia, we had a show at Silent Barn the same night. And, like, it was, like, Myrtle Broadway, and I'd never seen, like, that kind of a setup before. And, like, I was scared fucking shitless. I had all my shit and, like, my backpack and all that shit, and I was just like, people are gonna, like, rob me. This is gonna be, like, fucking... No, actually, no. Clockers, too. And, like movies, basically. And, like, I just thought it was really cool. Like, there's a lot of people at the first show.
Did you feel that people were more receptive to your music, or, like, got it more immediate than people back home?
That's a good question. I feel like, in general, I think New Yorkers are spoiled. And when I like...
In what way? I mean, sure, but in what way?
I think because so many people and so many artists and people like that feel like they have to come here to make it, they get to see everything.
Right.
So nothing impresses them.
I don't know if I'd go that
far.
To
a certain extent.
Yeah, I would say that the bar is a lot higher to get it, but I also think that drives the artistry, where it's, you might have been really great where you were, but when you come here, people are like, fine, we've seen it, but if you push yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
So did you think, like, hot shit coming in, and they're like, yeah, okay, you're a noise band. Great.
Honestly, like, I was just scared, because I thought, A, I thought no one was going to show up, and B, I thought they were going to be like, this is stupid. Like, what are you doing? Like, you're a child. What are you...
But I've also felt that New Yorkers, if you are genuine and you are coming from the right place, they're super receptive. I mean, they might not be like, oh, this is the best thing I've ever seen.
Right.
But they'll say, oh, that's cool. You're actually trying. Here's, like, four things you need to think about, or here's two people you need to meet.
Yeah. Yeah, I definitely got that vibe. I just said vibe. I'm almost 30. Why am I doing that? I got that impression when I first got here. Someone that I really revere, Chris Hansel, was at the first show, and he's told me it was really good, and I almost, like, shit myself. I was like, oh my god. Melts into chair. And yeah, I played with Ryan Martin, who does Deus Records, and Sadaf, who's fucking brilliant. And it was just weird, but I think I play here so often that people are just sick of me. So, like, the first few shows when I was here, felt, like, good to a certain extent, and then I think people just kind of, like, you're playing again.
They got spoiled.
Hell yeah.
They got spoiled. Yeah,
totally.
Can we hear another song? What are you gonna play for us?
Sure. Okay. This is a cover. That's all I'm gonna say. Ha ha ha. Let me see if this is actually on.
In the 8 years that we've done this show, you're one of the handful of artists that have written me to say, come see my show first before you interview me, just to understand it. What is it about the live show that gives context to Dream Crusher versus the recorded music?
The main thing is I was a visual artist before I was a musician, so that's the two intersecting is really important to me. And like, I don't really like passive music or passive visuals.
Yeah, I would say that show was not passive. I think when I saw someone dragging you by your feet while you screamed into the microphone, almost like a mop on the floor of Pioneer Works, that I would define that as non-passive.
Yeah, you know, a bitch is with it if it's with it. How you doing? I usually get interviewed by people who are just like heard about me on Pitchfork, and they're just like, and then like, I think the only time that actually panned out where like someone had written an article about me before they heard anything or saw me live, they canned it after they saw me play. Because they were like, that's not where we're going.
That's not what we thought. Yeah. And what leads? Does the music lead the visuals, or does sometimes the visuals lead the music?
I don't know. Sometimes, well, with this particular record that I'm working on, it was music first, which is, I think, the first time that's happened since I've been in New York, because I've only put out two actual records since being here.
Out of the 30 you've put out?
Yes. Yeah.
So only two. What were the name of the two that you put out here?
Hackers, all of them. Hackers was the first one, and then Quid Pro Quo was the second one.
So you're saying for the new one, the music is leading or is coming first?
Yeah, the thing that I try to do with the new material I'm working on now is like be a little more overtly political, because like with the way that I identify and the way that, I don't know, my clinical depression and all that bullshit, I want to reach more people that look like me, know, like, identify the same way as I do, as non-binary, and that type of stuff. So I want to like be able to reach them with what I'm saying, as opposed to just like being intentionally vague so it can reach everyone, because it never works out that way, because people are too stupid. So,
or it's too blank, or they just put their own impression on it.
Oh yeah,
you're like, please read the lyrics this time.
Yeah, I want people to know what I think.
when is the record coming out, or what's the plan for it?
I'm going to Beyonce it. I don't know.
Okay. It'll be on MySpace at some point.
You know, MySpace, Live Journal, Zanga, you know.
And any tours this summer?
I just finished a tour with Show Me the Body, but I think once, I'm hoping that the next project, singular and plural, that I'm working on, I'll be on tour while that's happening. So maybe, I want to say fall or winter.
Okay. So. Well, I want to thank you for coming on. I want to make sure we have time for one more song.
Okay.
Thanks for tuning in this week. Big shout out to Darren on the West Coast. If you like this, please go to iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe. Maybe leave us a review if you're feeling up to it. We are going to be back next week with a brand new episode of Snacky Tunes. What are you going to take us out with?
Another new one called Poison.
Thanks. Oh, and where can people find you? Follow you. Oh. Your Instagram game is super strong.
Oh, Instagram game on fleek. How you doing? I'm trying to completely divorce myself from all social media, because it's.
Oh, it, well then, in the limited time that you're still on.
Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Live Journal, Zanga. No, Tumblr is like the main thing. I'm Drinkrum on Tumblr. That's Drinkrum with an E at the end. Like, not like the Moloko milk bar one, but the one I made up because I was stupid and someone had already taken that username. Easiest way to get in touch with me is through Bandcamp. Please don't ask me to do things on social media. I'm not going to see it in time for it to be relevant. So,
good advice. All right. Well, thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. Close us out.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.